the Mock Stars Podcast. I am Menace, one of your hosts, and I'm here with Flash.
Appropriate amount of time has passed. I am not hearing the sound, but I bet it's done.
The technology will be with us one day where you'll be able to hear it, I swear to God. And we have...
Actually, I don't want to spoil the episode, but we have another person on the recording, and I am actually hearing the soundboard less, I think, than usual.
Really?
Because of that.
Okay. Well, spoiler alert.
Like, usually I hear it like a little bit in the background. I can hear like a faint from like 30 feet away underwater. Like barely hear it. Yeah. Didn't hear it at all this week.
Ah. Well, we do have a special guest. We've got Tyler on the line. What's going on, dude?
Hello. How are you guys doing this morning?
Fantastic. And it indeed is morning. I'm feeling the Dr. Pepper hit the veins just right now, actually.
Direct line. I'm feeling it, too.
Yeah, I've got my IV in, ready to rock and roll. If you guys would like to support the show, you can always find us on YouTube, where you can like, subscribe, and ring that bell for more notifications. And help us get to that magic number, 666 subscribers. We're going to get there soon. And then you can also support us on all major podcasting platforms by leaving us a 5-star review to make us look super duper cool. And support us on Patreon, where you can become an official Pepperhead for $3 a month. Become an official Pepperhead. Have your name turned Dr. Pepper Red on the Discord server. You can also support us at the Cherry Vanilla Pepperhead tier at $5 a month. Get your entry into each of our bi-weekly giveaways. Or support us at the 2-liter tier, like Definitely Jeremy, Poolboy Barry, UWP Quirt, and Aaron Becca. For $10 a month, get 2 entries into each of our bi-weekly giveaways. We also have Revenlift hanging out in the Mock Stars Dr. Pepper Lounge. Ever since we got that Dyson Bladeless fan, Revenlift has not left the beach. The new...
I mean, it's nice and cool in there.
Yeah, the nice...
Got the Bladeless fan.
Yeah, the beach installation is a success. It has definitely started to see water damage on the floor below us. With the wave pool that we had to put in and everything like that. It's just like...
Oh, sure. I've been on the phone with insurance all week.
Yeah.
Quite frankly. Insurance, contractors, the lawyers from the other tenants in the building. But, you know, it's worth it.
Yeah, absolutely worth it. And it can be worth it for you to join the Dr. Pepper Lounge, the Mock Stars Dr. Pepper Lounge, and chill on the beach with Revenlift, Vin Diesel, the Tasmanian Devil, Lola Bunny, and LeBron and his fake family. They are testing out our new patio seating arrangement for brunch this week. We got the reservation just yesterday, so I'm really looking forward to having them there, seeing as they will be eliminated from the playoffs by then, I'm sure.
So hold on. What time is that 8 top?
Oh.
With LeBron's family, Lola Bunny, and the Tasmanian Devil?
No, that's they're in at 11 a.m. prime brunch.
11 a.m. Okay, yep. Cool. All right.
Yep. Yeah.
I'm going to make a note of that in the reservation system.
Okay, cool.
Yo, I never took LeBron as a brunch guy. I'll be honest.
Huge.
Oh, he loved brunch. Loved it.
Huge.
Like you've seen him dominate on the court. Put a plate of Eggs Benedict in front of him. And he truly just goes in.
Dominates the GOAT, the greatest of all time at Eggs Benedict.
Yeah.
And we started making wine out of Dr. Pepper. So, like, he's a big wine guy. We just knew that, like, if we were going to have him as a regular, we needed to R&D that, you know, and make sure we had it ready for him. So, it's been a success. He says that he's never tasted so many flavors in one glass of wine. It's unreal.
27 of them.
I don't know where you're getting the other 4, but you know,
blackberry. Oh, dude,
sugar free is a flavor.
Yeah,
alcohol, you added 4: alcohol, sugar free, sweat, and goat. I don't know what else you need.
Yeah. No. Oh, yep. Yep.
There we go. 27 adds up.
Yep. All right. This week we are talking about all the good things about CEDH. No, that's not good, right?
Oh, boy. Blink-182 is rolling in their grave.
Yes. Yes, they are.
Oh, I have bad news. Blink-182 died.
What? When?
Yeah, they died. Yeah, unfortunately.
That is bad news.
Well, Mark Hoppus got abducted by aliens, which he always wanted. Mm-hmm. And then the other guys died.
Well, to brighten the mood, Tyler, what are the good things about CDH right now?
Yeah, just a couple key highlights that I think are really, really important and like fun about CDH is one, I think looking maybe not specifically at the meta at this point, but proxies are all over the place, running rampant. I'm seeing, you know, kids, 15, 16, 17 year olds at our locals who have Gaia's Cradles in their deck, who have...
they must have rich parents.
Grim Monoliths. Honestly, they all have printers at school, which is a phenomenal, phenomenal thing. I think, you know, the format as a whole and the community as a whole really wanted to stop playing against wallets and wanted to start playing against players. And so now that almost every single CEDH event I've been to, locals, I think community members just at like shops are just so much more open and willing and happy to see proxies at their table. So that's another like kind of huge win for the CEDH community. Go back a year ago, a year and a half ago, you know, it was pretty taboo to have that wasn't an official Magic card, and people would look at you funny and judge you, and you know, you'd get an "ew, you're poor" kind of look if you had proxies, even if you owned one copy and you just had a second printer paper for your other deck so you didn't have to swap them all the time.
I see that
as a huge win.
I've gotten that.
No, that's a recent development too, because the proxy thing was a huge gatekeeping thing in CDH for a long time.
But
right, because you needed the reserve list stuff, you needed the expensive cards, and so many tournaments gatekept proxies, like they just wouldn't allow them. So I think this is ultimately healthier for the format.
Yeah, absolutely. I am going to be the voice of public opinion. The dissenting nature will be where I come in and be the devil's advocate here. But Tyler, what about all the money I invested in my Magic cards?
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I hear that all the time. You know, I, before proxies got super popular, invested pretty heavily into Magic. You know, my Gaia's Cradle, my... Power Artifact, Grim Monolith, like I was in there, Alliance Eye Diamond, Wheel of Fortune, like I was buying reserve list cards well before the bans, and I still, or not the bans, the before proxies were allowed, and I still advocated for proxies. I think for the people who are super duper worried about like the value of their collection, you know, people who are sitting on a bunch of reserve lists or just kind of expect like mana crypts before they got reprinted, and was hoping to like put a down payment on a house or pay off their student loans with that in a couple of years. I do feel for you. I definitely felt, you know, I saw that Moxfield price number go down the more and more proxies got accepted. But my counter to that argument, or something I would kind of suggest, is one, you know, if you had an accountant or an investment person tell you Magic cards is the, you know, stuff into your mattress and sit on that and that's how you're going to pay for your retirement, that person clearly didn't know they were doing. And look at what they're doing with Secret Lairs. Look at what they're doing with new sets. What's killing the price of 99.999% of Magic cards is reprints. And I don't think anyone has ever said, please stop reprinting good Magic cards.
Well,
hey, speaking of Secret Lair and 99.99, the new price point for Secret Lair raised foils. Did we see this?
Yeah.
$99.
Yeah.
By the way, speaking of price gouging.
And so just so everyone is aware of like what that printing is, it's the same printing that was available on your new Capenna Rocco Cabaretti caterer, that gold raised foil that was met with lukewarm at best reception. So, yeah, kind of a strange choice for Wizards of the Coast to be like, yeah, you remember that stuff people didn't like or only liked about half of the time? Well, we're going to charge $100 for it for a bunch of cards. By the way, that bundle of cards In total,
not a valuable, inherently valuable bundle of cards.
Yeah, it was like $1.29, I think, is what priced it out at. So,
You know, to add to your point, it's Magic in general, and this is coming directly from the company that prints Magic cards, not a good investment.
Oftentimes,
like, does not respect the value of your money necessarily. Yeah. A lot of the times.
Yeah, a lot of the time when you hear about something that, like, oh, I knew this guy who, when he looked at his binder after 20 years, he saw he had two Black Lotuses and a bunch of Lion's Eye Diamonds because nobody wanted them. And, you know, and then he sold them and he bought a car or whatever. You've missed the boat. Like, you can still go to an estate sale, maybe get lucky. This is like, it is every find that happens, you get less and less lucky. There's no way that you should be of the mindset that these cards are going to be an investment, that these cards are going to appreciate in value so much that you are going to be able to purchase something greater of value with them. So that's ultimately why proxies for me as well have gotten to be such a safe space. I think that's a good, like, I feel so much more comfortable as a Magic player, like, when I enter a space that allows proxies, and CDH has been that home for me. So it's like, when I come to, I mean, when I'm at a tournament, it's like no judgments passed, because it is not about my wallet or how much I spent, because that Shalai and Halar deck I had was Mox fielding out at the time at like $11,000. And I was like, I have this? Why do I have this? And why am I just dragging it around in a tiny little box that can get easily lost or stolen? Right. And it was a risk, like, that I was not, like, willing to incur a lot of the time. And so I just stopped taking the deck place, start putting it in a safe spot at home, because it just was worth too much. And once I was just, like, adopted proxies, found out FedEx could print an entire deck for $9, and then all I had to do was cut it out. Oh, man. And they all looked just like looked like real Magic cards. A lot of people didn't even know that I was playing proxies for a good portion of the time. And then, it's all about the mind. It's about who you are as a player that determines how well you place in CEDH or in tournament play. So, like, that's what it should be about, right? This is a competitive format.
And the competition is not how much money you have. It's about how good you are at the game.
Exactly, right? It's how you handle situations, how you approach these things to inevitably result in wins, not, you know, how financially secure you are. So I think that's a great point to be made, is that the sooner you adopt proxies, this isn't like to go against purchasing Wizards of the Coast product either, because, like, if you are a collector, but, you know, and love, I don't know, there is a certain, like, feeling I get when, like, I bought the Deadpool Secret Lair, ripping that baby open and just feeling like having some nice cards, like foils, in my hands. I was just like, you know, this is actually rad. Like, I miss ripping packs, not $40 a pack, but, you know, like, I do definitely enjoy pre-releases and still, like, partaking in other formats and where you do have to have the real cards. So I still do see the allure of purchasing cards. I'm not much of a whale, but, you know, like, I do like having, like, the top end, or, like, finding a good deal on, like, a foil, let's say the dragon or the ghost fired halo foil for Clarion Conqueror. It's like $70. The standard print version is $2. The borderless double-sided foil that has the baby and the adult on the back is $4. I will spend $4 to get the borderless foil of a Clarion Conqueror. Like, and have and be whimsical and put the baby side on the front. Like, that there is a satisfaction in purchasing product and purchasing Magic cards, but I'm just happy to say that CDH has been a very comfortable, safe space for me to like test out new decks with proxies and not have to feel like I have to invest. Because when I look at Moxfield and I like I'm looking at the price of the deck at the very bottom, a lot of the decks that I test out are in the $4,000 to $7,000 range. So it's just not something I'm willing to like. I'm not dropping a car like a car payment or like the what you would need to drop on a car to yeah.
Well, I think you saying deck you would like to test is important because like, you know, in this, when you're building a deck and you're testing it out and you don't have reps for it already, if you're playing with real Magic cards, you're investing a ton of money, right?
Yeah.
Like it costs, like there's going to be random cards, random $4 and $5 cards that you're just going to have to pick up to fill out that deck and blah, blah, blah. Even if you're not chasing after, like, even if you're not building a meta deck and putting Lion's Eye Diamond and Mana Crypt and dual lands and stuff in there, it's going to cost you a few hundred dollars to build any deck with real cards versus with proxies. Either you send off a huge order to a factory in China and you have, you know, your bin of 1,000 proxies that you can build whatever decks out of, or you spend $9 at FedEx and you just print the deck and you test it out that way for a much lower investment. Like the floor is much lower for getting in.
Yeah. And now I do feel that people who had felt secure in their investment, because when I say like investment, what I generally lean towards is like I bought a dock side for $55. That was a good deal. My investment is $55 in order to play the real version of that card, right? Not to flip it and get some sort of return out of it. So I guess, and this leads into our next point, is that when the bans happened, like Dockside, Mana Crypt, Jeweled Lotus, and Nadu, all those, there was a really feel bad moment when that announcement came out, because of the investments that people made, because now you're no longer able to like really use those cards. So Tyler, I want to swing it back over to you here. Those bans that happened were monumental and like a dramatic turning point in the format in CDH. So I know you feel some sort of way about it. They were banned and you feel as though they should stay banned, correct?
I think so. You know, there's the big four, you know, the Mana Crypt, the Nadu, the Jeweled Lotus, and the Dockside. I think out of the big four, I think only one of them should get to come back. Not talking about so much why the one should be unbanned, like Jeweled Lotus, like, come on, it's a card literally only playable in one format for one thing. And if I have to hear one more pseudo vintage player be like, no, you ran in vintage because then you can do mana doubling, I'm going to freaking lose it. That's a lie. No one plays that deck. No one's ever played that deck.
I watched it's one
just
video.
A thought experiment.
I watched one video on it. Like, and it was funny. It was like funny to like be like, oh, you're building a bunch, you're doubling, using doubling cube to double a ton of mana that you can't even use.
Yeah, I just think that card is really only playable in one format. And, you know, you want to talk about the health and the blah, 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 and what it does and what it can't do. I'm just Tevish Zot. I'm just playing against it. I'm just playing with it. Free my homie. Unban Julius is really all that I kind of want to say about the what should be unbanned. But I do think the three other cards should stay banned. Yeah. And all of my takes are kind of coming from a fun aspect about CDH. I don't play a ton of TEDH as a background. I was a grinder. You know, Evan, I think you saw me at every single event you and I could possibly even go to all over Washington. I was a grinder. I'm not going to toot my horn too much, but I was a pretty consistent top 10, top 16. Justin, Tordeath, a big fan of the pod, likes to point out, always the bridesmaid, never the bride kind of thing for me. And so, like, talking first about Dockside, like, the card is so fun to be the player who plays it. You know, it feels so powerful. You know, it's turn 16. You've done absolutely nothing all game. You're playing some sort of infinite mana outlet commander, or even better, you're in like Esper playing Marnius, and someone else's Dockside has sat on the field for two turns and it made them like nine treasures, and they somehow didn't win the game with nine treasures, which, like, that's absurd. How did you not win the game with nine treasures? But then I have the one clone in my hand and I drop the clone, and then boom, I make 12 treasures, 20 treasures, and I spend it and I copy it again and I churn through my deck and then I win the game. That felt so awesome and great. You know, my heart would pound. I'm sure many, many listeners can kind of identify with the feeling of, like, I have two lands, you know, a soul ring and my commander, and I've done nothing all game. Oh, cool. I either got to my dockside or I get to clone someone else's dockside and now I win the game.
Yeah,
the flip side of that.
I was going to say, you named a few cards right there that are not really played anymore just due to the bannings as well. So, like, yeah, it's like clones you don't see as many of, like, anymore. Bounce effects, well, you don't see of as, you know, as much anymore.
Well, Dockside had so much gravity in the format.
Yeah.
And oh, yeah.
Marnius Kalgar, you don't see as much anymore, and that's sad.
That is sad. That is sad. You know, I'm the classic, like, ADHD, CEDH player who wants to have, like, seven decks put together and always playing them. And Marnius is always one of those. I really like that deck. I think Smothering Tithe is such a cool card. But, yeah, with Dockside being gone, there's a lot less gravitas to the deck. I definitely would say so. But with that being said, I'm still glad that it's gone, because on the flip side of that scenario, you know, whatever player, you know, I was playing Kenrith or Blue Farm Runner. I've had an absolute death grip on this game. I am sitting there. I've drawn so many cards with Timna and with Krom and my Adna. And you know, but because in the same way that I think some people feel like the flash enablers were problematic, like, oh, I can never tap out because someone might just cast Born Upon a Wind and win the game. That's how I feel like everyone felt, you know, with Dockside. I can't tap out. I have to hold up the swords, the plowshares in response to the Dockside ETB. Or, you know, I have to play less good cards, less enchantments, less artifacts, because I don't want to be the player that feeds the Dockside player. I think banning Dockside freed up a lot of design space. So, like, a card that people are playing again, one, because proxying is more friendly, and two, Dockside is banned, is like Carpet of Flowers. Carpet of Flowers is an absolute house in the format nowadays, in my opinion. It's green great decks, I think every green deck should be, because now everyone can play one Shock Island, like Steam Vents or whatever, and then one duel. And now that all the duels, everyone's playing all the duels, you know, tables that only would have maybe one or two islands now consistently after turn five or six have three or four islands. So Carpet of Flowers has been immense. I don't know if you guys have seen, maybe in your guys' local meta, an uptick in Carpet of Flowers, but our meta definitely has.
Yeah, no, it's...
I mean, I'm glad to hear that. Like, Carpet of Flowers, I think maybe a year or two ago, was a card that I'd always try to slot into a green deck, and then I would play it and just nothing would happen with it, you know. So Dockside leaving the format, and then this leading to the effect of, like, hey, we're playing more islands and it's now a good card. I'm happy to hear that. Like, it does open up space where, like, cards that should be good are now good, because you're just removing Dockside from the equation, and it's not all based around treasures, you know.
Yeah, where it used to do nothing, right? Where Carpet of Flowers would do nothing. There was always a threat of Carpet of Flowers around if you're playing against something in green. And, you know, like you were saying, with the, well, with proxies becoming more prevalent, people are more open and willing to print dual lands that they couldn't afford before and have them at the table. So, like, Carpet of Flowers is one of those things where it's like you land it turn one, right? And if you're third in turn order, like, or fourth, there's a good chance that you are not seeing another turn because someone else is going to get their second turn, play a Dockside. You're contributing to that count. It really depends how greedy the rest of the table was. But now that Dockside is gone, it's like, yes, enchantments that stick around for a long time, like, and provide, you know, like, continuous value turn after turn after turn, are more playable now, and, like, because you can't be punished for developing a bored state, which is what Dockside ultimately, that's what it was designed to do, was to even the scales, right? But it they just did not, they could not have foreseen how much it would unbalance, would throw the format into chaos. But it was, yeah. Now, I definitely see your point there. It's like, now, yeah, cards that didn't do as much before because of the threat of developing a board state now actually have, like, a much more, like, I would say, even say Smothering Tithe is a card that's far more prevalent now that Dockside is gone. Like,
yeah, it just opens up a greater diversity of play lines.
Yeah.
Because now not every game is going to go through a Dockside. Because that was the experience before when Dockside was legal. Every game went through a Dockside somehow.
I played Stony Silence. I played Collector Oof. I played, what's the artifact one? I can't remember. Because I
Null Rod.
Yeah, Null Rod. Because I just stopped playing them. Now that Dockside was no longer like a threat, I just stopped playing them. Like, sure, the One Ring, but like I was playing the One Ring. So, yeah, I'm just going to stop playing those cards. So those cards, yeah, it became way less relevant.
Yeah, and it's so tragic to see some cards like fall out of favor, like Blind Obedience, top two Magic cards of all time. Oh, like,
I
love that card.
I love
completely
it.
Unplayable now that there is no Dockside. Like, it just it simply doesn't matter.
Hey, I turn off your One Ring for a turn.
Turn, and you still got protection, and your Soul Ring came intact. No, like,
yeah. The only thing you're stopping is like Hullbreaker loops, but then they're like, yeah, I'll just bounce the Blind Obedience.
Well, and also with Dockside gone, like, is Hullbreaker Horror even played with Mana Crypt gone? Like, who's still playing Hullbreaker Horror?
Not a lot of
people. Kennen? It's like Kennen because they can kind of beat the tax on rocks. Like, a one cost and a two cost artifact does kind of get there. Like,
yep.
It's just, it's not a lot. Like, Atraxas still might play it because of Food Chain. And yeah, maybe like very niche Reanimator Thrasios decks. So with Dockside being gone, that strategy has become less relevant, which also doesn't seem terrible in my opinion. Like, as again, all of my takes are about for fun. A like turn, like someone into reanimate a Hullbreaker Horror just meant no one got permanence for the rest of the game, which I don't think is that terrible if I want to sit down with my buddies or sit down at a tournament. Because at the end of the day, I paid $50 to have fun, and I'm just using this tournament as an outlet for that fun.
Yeah.
But if every single game is miserable, I don't want to pay $50, pay the $50 in gas and then all the food to then sit there for 4 to 5 hours a game, it feels like, even though it's an 80-minute turn or an 80-minute game, and be miserable the whole day.
Yeah, absolutely. This is like we're extrapolating on a lesson in purpose behind why you show up to these events, right? Like, like some of us are gluttons for punishment. I will say that there are some people who go in and want to see success, and ultimately when they don't see that success are sour at the table, saltier in hell. But it's like we go to these things because we enjoy them, right? Like, and so the bans, why they should stay banned, Jeweled Lotus, I am in agreement. I do believe that can come off the list and would help bring back some decks. Like, it bring some decks back to life, like that were lost to this. Like you said, like Tevesat gone, just dead. And the beautiful thing is that our Thrall tokens were so sick. They're so sick, but they're no longer useful. So bring Jeweled Lotus back to make our Thrall tokens relevant.
If they do fall in Empires too, I'm sure they're going to come in useful.
We will have relevant tokens once again. Yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, there are cards out there that many a player thought, you know, this should be banned, or even cards that were not banned. Like, I would say, like, Rhystic Study was one of those that was heavily in the spotlight coming to what one particular player was calling Liberation Day. You know, like it's just like last Tuesday we were all expecting something to get banned, but instead we were surprised with an announcement that unbanned a few things out of the cards that were prospectively supposed to be banned, like Rhystic Study, like maybe Smothering Tithe, like maybe even something like Born Upon a Wind. Those weren't banned. They're still in the format. What do you think, and where are you at with these cards being still intermingled?
Yeah, for sure. I appreciate that question. I think there are like two camps of people, right? I think there are the camps of people who are like, ban the mid-range powerhouses, ban Rhystic Study, ban Talion. I guess no one's calling for the ban of Talion, but like that effect, ban Rhystic Study, Smothering Tide, like those effects that tax players, because that is kind of what feeds into what, you know, I've heard on the podcast be called like the mid-range madness. Loving that alliteration.
Glad it's sticking.
So there are people who believe that, you know, we exist in mid-range hell, mid-range madness, and therefore the answer is ban all the mid-range pieces. And then there's the other camp of people who believe that it's like the flash enablers. You know, Born Upon a Wind, Valley Flood Caller, the ley lines, like that's kind of where I feel like a lot of the things for when people call for bans. I think that everyone is right to a point. And I know that sounds very political and it sounds like I'm trying to ire no hatred.
How dare you agree with all of us?
Lock me up. But if you were to ban all of the mid-range pieces, then all the next tier mid-range pieces would just come up. You
exactly.
Pollywog Prodigy would be the new Rhystic Study, or maybe not exactly the new Rhystic Study. You know what I mean? But like, whatever engine can engine next will engine again.
Well,
that's how the game works.
Exactly. Like to that exact point, it's like the only reason that we're seeing these things be a problem in the first place was because we got rid of the primary problem makers, right? Like because we got rid of the things that were the biggest problem, like Dockside in the format, new problems came to light and you're like, oh, well now these things need to be banned because they're the biggest problem. And it's like, okay.
Well, I mean, for me, the big difference is that Dockside is explosive. Every time you drop it, it's explosive. It you know, the game is going to pivot around it every time. Whereas Rhystic, Smothering Tide, things like that, they're incremental. And even though they're taxing players, you can pay that tax, you know?
Yeah, that's what a responsible player would say. You know, but we're talking about the general public, like that have a problem.
We're talking about the malcontents.
Yes,
got it.
Yes, all the people who refuse to take responsibility for their own actions. So, like they don't pay for those things, and they go, yeah, take your card, yeah, take your treasure, whatever. Like I will say, Smothering Tithes tax is a little, you know, like it should have been one, not two, but here we are.
But also the other aspect of that is that it's incremental. You're getting one treasure at a time. You're getting one card at a time. It's not explosive in the way that Dockside is.
Right. But once Dockside left, we were left without explosive playmaking cards. And so the format generally like has swayed and leaned into this like mid-range madness, this slowed down version of what the format used to be. And so those cards now become pivotal pieces within the format. And that's where it's like, even if we did ban those, right, the game would change because it changed from something that was very explosive and like, you know, you could turn wins at like turn two, turn three. Now we're looking at turn five, turn six, you know, and if we banned Rhystic Study or Smothering Tithe, new problems would arise. And game.
Listen, I have a solution. Just play Pauper CDH if this is a problem for you.
Boom. PDH, it's out there. It's a real thing. And it's excellent, so give it a shot. Anyway, to allow you to continue your point, Tyler, the boogeyman cards will always arise. They will always come to the forefront.
And the reason that I think Smothering Tithe and Rhystic Study are the ones that, you know, denote the most ire is like, is Smothering Tithe good in a 1v1 format? Probably not. is CED8 or sorry, is Ristic Study a powerhouse in any 1v1 formats? Absolutely not. It's these cards just eat and feast and feed on the fact that there are three other players who can all trigger this effect. And I think that's fine. I think Ristic Study being able to punish three players who all play greedy, or even really punish three players for one player being really greedy, is fine. I think Smothering Tithe, you know, is guaranteed to trigger unless you have a Necro out on at least once every single turn, is fine. I think those effects are perfect for punishing the basis of playing the game. I think they just, their payoffs are too extreme. If Smothering Tithe instead said, instead of make a treasure, like deal one damage, I don't think that card is playable, right? But I think it's more fair and balanced. I think if Ristic Study, instead of like saying, you know, pay one or draw a card, it said like pay one and take a damage, the card is fine. It's just the effect is too powerful. And it makes the game, at the end of the day, not fun. And kind of transitioning this point to like what should be banned and what should not be banned, and talk about just like, are these cards fun to play against and play with or not? Like the Fashion Enablers also are the exact same problem. And I would really like to make the point that I don't think that like individual cards or the banning of cards is the problem. It's the fact that mid-range keeps getting away with mid-range. The mid-range problem is exactly that. It's not a meta problem. It's a mid-range problem.
Everyone's just playing mid-range.
It's what everyone's doing. And there's only been like one player I've ever seen at a tournament really build a deck to bust the meta. Because everyone thinks like, I'm a victim of this, but like when I show up to a tournament, I'm the main character. I'm the Yugi. I'm the ass catcher of that tournament until I don't win. You know what I mean? And every single player, A, should, and B, does kind of have that feeling. A lot of people show up and they see their opponents as just like speed bumps to getting to the anime, you know, intro, you know? And so
yep,
we all want to do the mid-range thing. Like players like Anvil Dust Atlas, who we've seen be very successful with his mid-range flash over the top strategy, everyone wants to do it now because it wins games. And I'm not hating on that at all. I'm a victim. I play Atraxa for goodness gracious. I am all about sit there, sandbag, draw, win the game over the top, or just I've accrued so much value, there's absolutely nothing you can do to stop me. But if we want to talk about flash being a problem or mid-range being a problem, more players need to start playing decks to bust it. So, you know, in that triangle of turbo mid-range stacks, we're seeing players turbo and they have the kind of the correct mentality. It takes 2-3 turns for mid-range decks to effectively set up to stop me. If I can just get there on turn 1 and 2, it doesn't matter. But with the bannings, it's really hard to get there on turn 1 or 2. Mana Crypt being gone, like, absolutely cut the kneecaps off of mid-range, so you can't turn 1 Demonic Tutor, turn 1 Ristic Study, turn 1 or 2 Smothering Tithe, 100%. But now, post-Nos, I've got 4 things that maybe make mana after, and that's really, really tough to do. So if we want to start having more fun and we want to start punishing the mid-range hell, people need to start busting mid-range. So how do you do that? So like for me, one of my solutions is stacks. Every single mid-range win con is like Thorpal or some way to make infinite mana with multiple costs. I think Rule of Law is going to go absolutely crazy in the current like banning and unbanning.
Yep.
Because, you know, Gifts being really the only real card that got unbanned, maybe Coalition Victory is like a one spell win the game, but if you're playing Coalition Victory, like, ew, so good luck.
Hey, Child of Alara became relevant.
I'm super glad that you think that.
I'm here for you, UWP player. I'm here for you. I'm rallying. I'm here for the Child of Alara meta.
That would be if I lost to Children of Alara resolving a Coalition Victory, I would shut my mouth for the end of days.
Yeah, it's gonna happen.
I believe. I think like get down. Let's get back to Commander's Commander. You know, let's get to Beats. I'm just going to hit you with a 7-7 every turn until you, what can you born upon the wind my combat damage? Probably not. So like, I think decks like Rocko stacks, I think Jetmir might even have some legs just with how slow the format is.
Yeah, and I know Tormoth has been leaning towards that quite a bit.
Yeah. Two Timnas is a pet deck of mine. And the whole point of that deck is it plays every card that says if you take a game action, it either punishes you or I get something that's way better than whatever you're doing. So a perfect example of like a mid-range busting stacks piece would be like Kumball. The one that says anytime you cast a non-creature spell, deal two or you take two damage and I gain two life, or Blood Chief's Ascension. Yeah. So cards like that, I think, are really going to be what's necessary to like bust up this meta. Because if the gameplay pattern of every TEDH game is going to be, I'm going to just amass so many resources, wait for the very last end step and then punish that. I want my board to be static stacks effects that say every time you try and take any game action, I'm going to punish you. That's really the only way to kind of like stop this, because some players are talking about we'll just run more removal, like maybe counter spells aren't as effective and we just run more removal and remove every Smothering Tithe and remove every stacks piece. But that's just mid-range hell with less cool cards. Like that's all that turns into.
Yeah, the idea of a deck building, and this is ultimately where we've gotten away from, is because there are tournament results just ready and available at a whim, you know. So it's like you can go out and you can see what is working, but what has worked in the past and what is continuing to work today are these mid-range madness decks that are just like sit and accrue value, sit and draw cards, sit, generate treasures, like let the game come to you. Like that is ultimately what has proven to be successful and gives you the greatest conversion rate. That is what the meta is comprised of mostly right now, is our decks that are just like, yeah, like draw a card, draw a card, draw a card.
You have the information. You can look at those decks and figure out how to beat them.
Yes, exactly. So like, that's the other side, right? Is like, yeah, now you like we've seen what has been successful for so long. And this is what I hate those decks. I hate them so much that I brainstorm to beat them 90% of the time. Like the other 10%, I'm thinking about, you know, what show I'm going to watch on TV. The other 90% of the time, it's literally just thinking about how much I hate Blue Farm. So like that's like whenever I'm building decks, that's I'm thinking about building in a way for me. One, that's fun because I want to have a good time when I'm at like when I'm at a tournament or just sitting down and playing. In general, like at MagicCon, is like that's why I built Helga, and that's why I love Shalai and Halar, is because those are very fun decks for me. But the goal isn't to sit and like there are certain stacks decks that just set up stacks and then pray to fall into their win conditions. That you are doing the exact same thing as the mid range madness thing when you do that,
you know, but being like, more annoying about it.
Yeah, and you know, like building a deck that generates incremental value with each play, like you're saying, like you take a game action, it gets me one step closer, like putting a Kumball down like brings the game closer to a close, you know. But I guess to my point is like when I'm building those decks, it's like everything in combination with one another leads to a win. I'm not intending to draw the game out, or I'm not intending to take it as far as I can to gain as much information as I can, but I do draw inferences from like the other players at the table to say like, hey, now is my window, right? So it's like building a deck that is off meta, has a win condition that is a little less known, but is explosive, is also another way to build that can combat this mid-range madness where, like, yes, there are players who are playing counter spells or playing are going to have timely removal that will set you back a turn or two or whatever. But like continue building decks that walk towards the goal of winning the game. You need to have that like in your mind of I'm sitting at this table not to see if I can win, but to win, right? Like there have been games where there have been a couple tournaments where I'll start the tournament like 0-2. Like this is when Dockside was still around, but it was just like, you know, like you'd have a couple, lose a couple games, but then, you know, like four or five rounds of Swiss, you got to turn it on. Like you have to flip a switch in your brain that says, you know, I need to think more critically about what hands I'm keeping at the top. But like, I've actually like felt that, it's almost like breaking the wall, but like you feel that flip switch and you just, I don't know, the games just come to you. It's just like you play so much better. But
Listen, if you're in a competitive format and you're not thinking like that, then you don't belong in that competitive format. Like it's, everyone is competing with each other. Everyone should be trying to get better. That is the purpose of playing in a competitive format.
Yes. And
like, if you don't have that mentality, it's just not for you.
Yeah. And I think this is where we can now make the point and draw the line on, you know, like what is CEDH, right? It's competitive EDH, Commander. And then what is TDH? What is this like term that is now growing, like that is now starting to make its rounds, and people are starting to say, you know, like, I don't play CEDH, I play TDH. Tyler, could you help me understand where that line is, and like when I've crossed it, or when a player decides to stray into that territory?
Yeah, I think the mentality is the biggest shift. A CEDH player in a CEDH deck in a CEDH setting is, you have an unlimited time, you know, quote unquote, unlimited time to resolve a game. Now, most CEDH games are not played to a TEDH standard. You know, most CEDH games are either like, hey, it's Tuesday night, all of my buddies want to get together and we want to do something that we have fun doing, and we're gonna play CEDH. It's the same thing as a bunch of guys getting together and watching football, or a bunch of people getting together and playing golf or doing their hair. Like, it's just the medium to hang out with your buddies, and that's a CEDH kind of mentality. You build the most powerful deck and you play to win, and then at the end of it, someone wins. TEDH is, I'm showing up to this event. I am playing with what I'm going to assume is mostly strangers, or I've been to so many events, I know everyone, but I only really know them as a TEDH player. I am here to get as many points as humanly possible, make the cut, get to my top four game, and win.
And win!
And that is the difference, is a CEDH deck wants to win the game. A TEDH deck wants to get as many points as possible. And there are two ways to get points there's really three ways to get points at a TEDH event, at a tournament CEDH event. It's get a bye, which is a win with bad breakers, get a draw, or win the game. And what happens in every single TEDH game that I've ever been in is 80-minute rounds. Once we hit like the 50-minute mark, one player thinks that they can win the game, and the three other players go, I'm going to do everything I can to get my point. So they all gang up the one player.
Right.
They've all spent their resources to stop the one player who thought they could jam a win in time, and then they all go, all right, I'm out, you're out, you're out, super, let's call it a draw. And then they draw the game, because a draw gets you a point. That's really the difference. And so if, like, I really identify as a CEDH player, I want to jam games, and like, I'm super down to show up to a random LGS, you know, sit down, kind of have that rule zero conversation. Hey, I only really have CEDH decks. Do you want to play CEDH? Oh yeah, sure. Blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I'm not going to dog them for missing their triggers. I'm going to remind them that, you know, hey, that static effect says you can't do that, so take it back, instead of like calling a judge and getting them a GRV. Because everything you do in the TDH environment is to stop your opponents from getting points and you getting as many points as possible.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's that is a great line, actually. That is a firm line in the sand. you know, between the brunch area and where the Dyson bladeless fan is. And it's, you know, like if you are, and this is where I think that the bracket system might need an additional bracket or a way to draw a line, seeing as they want to, like, when you go to MagicCon, if you go to these events, there are commander tournaments, with some with precons, which I think still falls into the realm of TEDH, because you are like actively trying to score points to or win tickets or whatever it is, whatever the thing that generally results in a reward is, you are hunting for those. So you know, there is an additional line in the sand that you need to know that you are crossing before you enter one of these events. And I think that's a great, like what you just did is explain it concisely, is that like when you're playing CDH, you're playing to be competitive. You're trying to win the game, but there is no time limit. And so the pressure is sort of like removed. That pressure is sort of removed from the stakes, right? And then, yeah, and there are also no points involved. Where when you go into TDH, yeah, there are points involved. You are actively trying to make the final cut. Like it's once you said it, I was like, no, yeah, you're right. I do flip. I turn into a different type of creature when I walk through the door into a tournament. It's like, yes, I say hello to everybody, but I have a different look in my eye and I'm less like, yeah, what's up? Yeah. Don't talk to me right now. I'm focused.
Yeah. know, like,
so it's a massive shift. Like, where if you are not in that mentality, like when you walk through the door that you are here to score points and do everything that you can in order to score those points, then you will slowly see yourself tumble down the ladder and be at those bottom tables and likely find people of a similar mindset. But if you consistently going to tournaments and noticing that you're not making the final cut, a shift in mentality needs to happen, you know. But yeah, there are still ways to have fun in TDH, and there's still, like, I think that if you're looking to have fun in a competitive way, CDH without the clock is that's your alley, and that's your avenue. Playing the most high powered magic you can, like with some forgiveness for your and some grace for your opponents, and then, you know, TDH, yeah, is like, it's a different type of fun for people who crave the competitive nature of maximizing their decks, maximizing their time, and maximizing the amount of points they can get. You know, like Atlas at one point, like, and this, I was going to make this point earlier when you're talking about like mid range and everybody wanting to do that right now. Well, the proof is in the pudding, right? That like Atlas climbed to number 3 in the world, you know, doing what he does best, which is sort of mid ranging out the game and then creating a situation that is favorable to him. And so, you know, like people see that success and they want to emulate it. They can't quite copy it exactly because each player has unique style and recognizes different windows. But yeah, it's like, yeah, a lot of people are envious or crave that that level of success. And I think it was the top 3 players in the world were all mid-range decks. So it's like, yeah, of course people want to play the best decks in the format. So if you're looking to have fun and if you're looking to find your unique space to exist in CDH, build something a little bit more like your boy Menace here. Have something a little bit more fun and like a Zakama infinite loop that kills with Den of the Bugbear. You know, there's little, like, there are fun strategies out there that are viable, you know, and then in TDH, that's probably not going to score many points. I'm going to be honest, it doesn't. Like, I've tried it.
Well, no, but at the same time, you have information about what the meta is. You could build Jank that preys on the meta if you wanted.
Exactly. Right. You can. So, like, you just have to figure out where people are winning and how they're winning, and then be creative. That, like, and it sounds like, oh, all you got to do is be creative. It's easy. It's not easy. It requires a lot of reps, and it requires a lot of, like, testing the dam for weaknesses. So, in order to figure out what's wrong, or, like, what you can do to, like, start winning against decks that primarily feast on the mid-range aspect of the game, you're gonna probably want to at least get some TDH experience. And now that you know where the line is, you can get reps in and CDH with your buds and stuff like that, and sort of understand things. But then also know that when you're practicing for TDH, that, you know, that's also a rule zero discussion to be had. Is like, hey guys, love playing with you. I'm hoping to get some reps in for tournament. Can we do that? Like, and then the mentality should shift into something a little more serious, right? So, I guess now I'm at a dead end here with my thought. But
yeah, can I kind of make like two closing points before we close this out?
Dude, absolutely. Yes, I was hoping someone would take the wheel.
For sure. While you're talking, I really kind of resonated with this point. So I'm a big golfer. I love golf. You know, some people say golf's really hard. Some people say it's really easy, but I'm of the camp. Golf is really, really hard. And it's really, really hard almost in the same way that CEDH and TDH is really, really, really hard, which I know the Venn diagram of people who golf and people who play TEDH has to be like literally just me. But there's this old adage in golf that says for every 1 minute you spend on the course is 10 minutes you should spend on the range. And I think that speaks so resonantly with kind of CEDH and TDH and people who want to have fun in both. I think there's a lot of people who will show up to TEDH events with the strongest deck that they net decked 2 weeks ago, playing four games with it. And then they're like, oh my gosh, why didn't I win? I'm playing Blue Farm. Blue Farm plays itself. It's like, But I really, truly, in my heart and soul, believe that you can be a third-rate duelist with a second-rate deck, but if you've played that deck 50 times in the last 2 weeks and you've played it 300 times all the time, like you can win. I think a perfect example of that is looking at a pretty big tournament that happened recently with Connor playing Zuladog. I have never seen someone stick to a deck harder than Connor does to Zuladog.
Yep.
Taking it to every event. I don't think I've ever seen Connor play anything other than Zuladog, other than when it's like, I want to do a fun casual thing. And Connor rips it every time at every event. Top is pretty consistent, but that's just because Connor knows what deck do deck good. It's just that simple. And yep. So
10 minutes on the range.
For every one game of TEDH you want to play, you should be playing five with the deck to really practice it. Know what good mulligans look like. Yep. You know, a lot of players are like, oh man, if I rip this land off the top, but like, do you know if you're going to rip that land off the top? I know in Atraxa, if I've got this many cards and I need to hit the land, it's just because I've been playing it for so long. Like, am I or am I not going to hit the land? I've got a feeling when I play the deck, and a lot of players miss that at TEDH events.
Right.
And kind of coinciding with the point that I'm making now into the second point is, what is winning to players? Like, I feel a lot of players, if they don't win the event, don't feel like they won at all. Or if they didn't make the cut, they didn't win at all. And setting realistic goals, setting realistic mentalities on what is a win, I think is really important. I want to shout out a TEDH grinder, David Bryden, who plays like Niv-Mizzet, does not show up to every event expecting to win. He might yuck me a little bit for saying this, but he I don't even think he expects to win any games when he shows up.
No, David.
But I've never. Oh, sorry, you go.
Oh, David's a G. Like,
oh yeah, big uppercase G, love that guy to death. But when he wins a game, he's ecstatic and feels like that's the victory he needed. David cannot win a game, can lose games, and still like, I cast Niv, I drew like 13 cards, I interacted like the player who's trying to win this game, I used my Pact of Negation at the perfect timing. those are all wins. Right. And I try and emulate that with every game. Did I win every single game tonight? No. But did I make correct, honest, holistic plays that could have won me the game if things shaked out a little differently? Yes. And I'm not sitting here like, tell your bad beat story to all your friends and try and frame them as wins. What I'm trying to say is, did you do something that you wouldn't have done last game that was better? Yes, that's a win. Seeing improvement in CEDH is really hard. It's kind of like the fighting game conundrum. You can get better at a fighting game and still lose every single game. And so you don't think you're getting better. But I think really
failure is a powerful teacher.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I'm sure Atlas, someone who got ranked 3 in the world, would say, you know, you've got to win 100 games before you've got to lose 100 games before you can win one. Like, people like to act like Atlas has never lost a game ever. Like, he got this good because he stuck through it, focused on small wins, and got better at the game. And that, I think if more people adopted that mentality, everyone would have so much more fun instead of valuing their existence as a CEDH player based off of how many points or a ladder ranking that, you know, they have.
Yeah, take your small victories, and recognize that they were like small victories. So the deck did what it was designed to do, and it just didn't shake out like the way that you had hoped. Okay, back to that's a little win, right? I implemented this strategy into the deck and I saw it happen, but it didn't result in a win. Okay, now chalk that up to, was that just a unique scenario in that particular pod because I was playing against two very unique decks I've never seen before? Or is that something I should take back to the drawing board? Is this strategy not, you know, as effective as I'd hoped? Okay, let's brainstorm and find what is going to ultimately get there for that W, or help, you know, and then when you see that strategy unfold, the one that you implement, to me, that's a small victory, right? The first time that I won off of a Cindervines, I just was I almost ran out the door. It was one of the most unreal things in the world. It was Shalai, Halar, Red Terror on the board. Cindervines, pay one, sacrifice it, destroy that thing, deal 2 damage to you, trigger the whole thing. You know, and then I'm winning. And I'm running through the room and, you know, in my mind, with my arms out, flying like an airplane. You know, woohoo. So, yeah. You know, it's find your things, even if it's not winning the game. There have been times in CDH where I've cast a lesser known card, Rampage of the Clans. And when it resolves, I feel like I've won that moment. You got to reflect on where you can improve. If you want to be a TDH player, and this is just as in general is for your growth as a player, right? Is see strategies that work. If you think they're fun or funny, or, you know, ask players ask your opponent, how does that work? That looked like a lot of fun. Can you teach me how to, you know, how that works or whatever? I think what the most rewarding conversations I've ever had are when, you know, I ask people about their decks or they ask me about mine, right? That's how I've met so many great players too. So this isn't just, and that's another aspect of CDH and TDH that is often overlooked, is holy crap, is there a great community aspect to it? Just if you open up and when the clock isn't running, just ask somebody, be like, yo, what's that deck you're running? What lines are you looking for? Are you adding, you know, are you going to add in or whatever? You know, how did you get to where you're at now? Right. Getting that perspective is often very rewarding and fun to get to know somebody a little bit more, because you're likely going to see them again at a tournament if you go. So that's an aspect we didn't even touch on. But yeah, there's a lot of cool people. I met Tyler.
Hey,
you know, so in Tordeth and Atlas and the whole Pacific Northwest PNW CDH scene, you know, it's if you've seen me out there, as well. Like, yo, I'm so happy and glad to have met you. Like that. That's another part of the fun is while the stakes might be high and it might be serious while at the table, when the clock isn't running, get to know somebody a little bit. Right. There's a reward in being a social creature. But yeah, the game requires a lot of practice. It requires a lot of reps. And I think the driving range is a perfect example. Like it couldn't be better said, is that if you want to master your drive, right? That's your opening hand, right?
Yeah.
Run your reps. Like sit there at, like, I remember, like I'll sit at home, I'll shuffle my deck and I'll just deal out seven, see if it's something I want to keep. Right. And just theorize how my first couple turns might play out. And then, you know, that's the driving range. And then like that's, or at least it's an aspect of it. And then, when you're out playing with your friends and stuff like that, like, yeah, it's go time. Right. And then you're still at the driving range, but you're taking it a little bit more seriously. And just sort of like seeing where the cards lie, how people are going to interact with certain things that you do, and how to avoid making mistakes and all those things. So, yeah, Tyler, thank you for that reference, because I think it's perfect. And I don't care what the Venn diagram says about golfers. And, you know, I think there's a larger thing to be said about how many Yu-Gi-Oh references you've made throughout the course of this. You know, like, how many pot of greens are you ripping off the top, you know? Like
every time, at least two.
Yeah,
at least two.
Oh yeah, draw two cards, it's time to did it, did it.
Drop this game.
All right, any closing final thoughts on, well, yeah, like on this discussion on the fun of CEDH.
Yeah, really my closing thought is just have fun. Do what you need to do to enjoy this format. I fear that we are getting into kind of this mentality, this rut, that if I can't win, I don't want to play, which I get. I am someone who is driven by winning, but also just adjusting your mentality that winning looks and sounds like and feels like something different than just being the person who gets the points at the end of the game is really important. And find a play group, find an LGS. You know, so many games are run on like Tabletop Simulator or Discord or Spelltable. Find a community and just have fun. And I guarantee you, the more games you play having fun, you will get better. You will become more TEDH viable. Let every game you play be like class and TEDH events just the finals. And if you have that mentality, you're going to spend a lot more time with magic cards in your hand smiling than gristling and grueling and looking at a clock. Because at the end of the day, that stuff just isn't fun. Like a TEDH game can be fun and a TED event can be fun, but the gameplay is secondary to the fun in those environments, where I really think if people just played a lot more casual games or a lot more like tournament practice games than they are now, the quality of cards, the banning and unbanning, the deck building becomes less important, and it's more about just having a good time. And I really hope listeners have more good times playing Magic. And I hope that this episode helps them find the community, the outlet, the mentality, so that they can have fun.
Love it. Concise. Brought it to, I think that's a great closing thought. I don't think I have anything to add either, except get out to the driving range. Like, get out there, get your reps in, practice. Like, there's nothing greater for me as a person is to see growth in myself, right? That is a very fulfilling thing for me. So get out there, practice, see that growth in yourself, reach fulfillment, because this is the number one podcast on the internet for Magic the Gathering and Dr. Pepper and Don Cheadle, which we haven't mentioned yet. Don Cheadle, we love you. Make sure you like, subscribe, and ring that bell for more notifications on YouTube. Every like every thumbs up, every subscription goes to putting more clothes on Don Cheadle's back. You can also support us via podcasting platform of your choice by leaving us a 5-star review. Make us look super duper cool. And you can also support us on Patreon by becoming an official Pepperhead. $3 a month, become an official Pepperhead. Have your name turned Dr. Pepper Red on the Discord server. And you can also support us at the Cherry Vanilla Pepperhead tier, like maybe Anthony, KB, Mono Greg, who we did find out is a Mono Green player. And a huge shout out for the Dr. Pepper Blackberry Zero Sugar recommendation. Get out there. It's an additional 2 flavors. And then we also have Jacob Hibbard, Tommy Cypher, K Mr. K, and Will Rule. Thank you all for your support. We truly do appreciate it. And we're out. Peace.
Bye.
Bye.
Oh, and thank you, Tyler. Thank you, Tyler, for being here.